Hi, it's Mark Hurst, and it is May 24, 2023, a great day to record a conversation with my longtime friend, Tricia Davies. Hi, Tricia.
Hi, Mark. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Now, I have to set a little context for listeners who know me but don't know you, Tricia, or maybe vice versa. They know you, but they don't know me. Here's the deal. Through my company, Creative Good, I write about technology, strategy, and customer experience, mostly in the world of companies and occasional nonprofits. But Tricia, you have a different focus, though you have a similar company name. Why don't you introduce yourself?
So thanks, Mark. So I started my company. It's a very small consulting firm in New York City. And I started out by naming it The Public Good. I've switched it to now Public Good Consulting because the public good domain was already purchased 30 years ago. But I call it The Public Good because my focus has been on working, pretty much my whole professional career has been working in the public sector, public domain, working with governments, nonprofit organizations, mission-based for-profits occasionally, philanthropists and funders who fund sort of mission-based organizations and product projects. So that's what I do.
So we have the public good, is it public good consulting? Is that what you called it?
Yeah. I mean, I started out by calling it the public good. That was sort of my brand. I still use the name on my website because that's kind of been the brand I've used for 17 years now.
Wow.
But yeah.
Public good
consulting. Yeah.
Public good consulting. And what's the domain for people to find you?
Yes. So you can look for www.publicgoodconsulting.com or www.thepublicgoodconsulting.com.
So just keep consulting on the end of it before the .com. And then my domain is creativegood.com. And it's I registered this early enough that no one had registered creativegood.com, so I got it. And similarly, Creative Good is a consulting firm, also a kind of a laboratory for different projects and experiments I've tried over the years. And I have this newsletter that I've written now for 25 years. It's one of the longest email newsletters around. And so writing, consulting, occasionally speaking. But I felt like it'd be good to have a conversation that we recorded, Tricia, because we've been speaking recently and having good conversations about this complementary skill set and experience base that you and I have. You have such deep expertise in the public sector, as you said, with a variety of clients. And I have mostly experience in the private sector. But as we were having these conversations recently, we were just marveling at how similar some of our takeaways and lessons have been over the years, that what we've seen in those two very different domains, actually what we've seen has been very similar.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, I've been familiar with your work for a number of years and read your book and I always enjoy reading your blog posts because one of the reasons why I also reached out to you is because what I think is really interesting, what I enjoy about reading your work and talking with you is that you bring this very sort of deep and I think very honest approach to the way that you view, you know, any type of product or experience being developed or designed and put out there. And I really appreciate that. And what I thought would be interesting for us, and I think we've already had some interesting conversations, is that while I've read your work as mostly focusing on sort of the fields of technology and maybe consumer products, finance, those areas, those industries, and my area is in the public sector. And I find that oftentimes people sort of make these distinctions like, well, no, you can't really, they're very different. And they are different, but I think it would be interesting to explore sort of your approach to how you, what you bring to the table in terms of helping your customers or your clients create and design products and services. And from my perspective, I guess I also like to push back a little bit because I, while I do think that there's definitely areas for overlap, and I think there's so many opportunities that people working in the public sector can learn from people like you. I do think that it's important also to always to bring forth and to acknowledge the limitations or the challenges that work in the public sector represents. So, for example, my work doesn't necessarily, being in the public sector, there's less about product design. It's more about product, or it's more about experiential design. It's more about the experiences that we bring to people, you know, experiences that we have in everyday life, whether it's public transportation, riding buses and subways, or sending our kids to public schools, or having access to a free and open park space. Those are the things that those are the areas that I work in. And so, and those come with their own sort of challenges because they're not necessarily designed for private consumption. It's not about, you know, other than, for example, subways where, or buses where you have to pay to get on the bus or subway. They are designed mostly for being as inclusive as possible and being able to open the, you know, experience up to as many people as possible. So I would love to sort of just talk a little bit more about you and your work in terms of what you've done and how there may be things to learn or grow on in the public sector and where there might be sort of areas that could be difficult or challenging, but I don't know, all of it's really good. So yeah, that's kind of why I was thinking like we could talk about a lot of things, but you know, just sort of talking about like maybe even starting out with, I'm curious to know your approach to working with a client, let's say designing some experience, for example.
Sure.
Yeah. What's important?
Well, first, thanks for bringing up my book, because that's what I often fall back on when I need to talk about my approach. The book is called Customers Included. I came out with a second edition of it back in, I think, 2015. And there's more information at customersincluded.com. So thank you for reading it and brushing up on it before the conversation. Basically, the idea of the book, which is the foundational idea of creative good, is that if we want to create an experience for someone else, that is to say, if we're a company or an organization, even a nonprofit, as you say, creating an experience for someone else outside the walls of this organization, we have to first understand what that other person wants. We cannot simply come up with an idea that we half-baked on a whiteboard inside our conference room and then just send it over the transom and, you know, and pray that it's going to work. That's not a smart way of product management or experience design or any of those buzzwords. So what I'm trying to say, even just from the title of the book, Customers Included, is that when we're creating something for someone else, we have to include them some way in the design and conception of the product itself. Now there's a bunch of ways that companies over the years have suggested doing this. There's these fancy co-creation methods where you bring a customer, or I'm using customer generally. It could be a patient,
yeah.
A student.
I don't usually
citizen.
Use the term customer because I feel like it denotes something you have to pay for.
Of course.
And so, but I understand that we can use that generically.
We could say a member of the public, you know, in the public sector, a citizen. Yeah. You bring a citizen in to co-create this thing, whoever it is that you're trying to serve. But the problem with some of these fancy methods of co-creation is that we have to understand the customers / citizens, they are not designers. Mm-hmm. That's our job.
Right.
So pushing off the design responsibilities onto other people is not going to be a winning strategy. Instead, what we should do is spend some, this is really radical. And I'm serious. I'm not being facetious. Yeah. This is a radical idea for a lot of companies out there, to go and spend time with the people that you're supposed to be serving, and observe them, talk with them, and infer what it is that they want. Mm-hmm. I say infer because another flawed method out there is to go out with a survey or a list of questions like, please describe mm-hmm. your ideal experience. Again, asking the person to design the experience. People, they know internally what they want, but they can't always verbalize it mm-hmm. if they're put on the spot like that. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. instead, you spend time with them, you observe them. And I have a whole middle section of the book where I'm talking about this method of listening labs that mm-hmm. that Creative Good pioneered way back in the 1990s to spend time with people and understand what their needs are, and mm-hmm. then start to put together some basic building blocks of what the design is. Mm-hmm. The book doesn't, in terms of design methods, the book does not go much further than that, because just getting to that very first step, clearing that very low bar of including customers, would make a huge difference in so many right. products and experiences that right. I thought, let's not take this to the nth degree. Let's just make a very, very simple case for yeah. including customers rather than ignoring them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so here's the thing. It's striking, because what you're describing almost reminds me of sort of like an anthropologist's work, right? Where you're out in the field and you're just, you know, quietly observing and taking notes, and maybe, at least from what I've read in one of the examples you gave of the Prospect Park study. And I want to talk about that for a minute, because I would love to ask you a few questions in terms of, and some of the things that struck me about that example in your book and this process of including customers. So where I come from, in my experience of working with clients who are either nonprofit organizations and they're looking to create a space that, you know, is designed for a community. So, for example, you know, in a particular neighborhood. So it might be a, you know, specific to a demographic or geographic location. You know, alternatively, it could be like understanding what people throughout the city experienced during, for example, the COVID crisis, and how did the city respond to it, and how can we create better programs through public mechanisms, public financing, that would help to make sure that we don't have the same bad experiences next time around, that we create better experiences. So doing it through a process of learning and listening. And I haven't really seen in my work, I haven't really seen a lot of that what you're talking about in terms of spending some time basically sort of working with, not just doing a survey, not just doing focus groups, because I do a lot of that myself with you know, customers or constituents, but you know, the process of actually being with the persons in their sort of journey. So maybe can you? I want to just bring up the case of the Prospect Park case, because what I thought about that was what was really interesting. And one, you mentioned this idea of, you know, just being with the customer, like literally, you know, that experience that you had. And I thought also it was really interesting the way you started out the process, which was the piece with the dogs on the leash and that sort of that rule that the city had, and that you found out was something that, well, let's see if we can change that rule. So maybe can you tell me a little bit about that project and what was interesting about it and how you engaged with your customers in the Park project?
Sure. Well, for people who are not from New York, they need to understand something about Prospect Park. There's New York City has a bunch of beautiful public parks in our park system. Prospect Park is one of the biggest, and it's one of the most beautiful. People from Brooklyn, where Prospect Park is based, would say Prospect Park is the most beautiful park in New York City. I live in Manhattan, so I'd probably go with Central Park. But the interesting thing is that the designers of Prospect Park were the same as the designers of Central Park, these two 19th century park designers named Fox and Olmsted. And they were really excited about what they came up with for Prospect Park. It's about a square mile in the middle of Brooklyn, and it has hills, it has water, it has meadows, it has all sorts of natural features. And in the depths of the New York City financial crisis in the late 1970s, the mayor brought on a new, I think she was 35, a pretty young new administrator for Prospect Park, this woman named Tupper Thomas. And they asked her to turn around Prospect Park's fortunes, but of course there was no budget. So what Tupper Thomas did, rather than running big strategy projects or bringing in expensive consultants or something, she did exactly what I urge people to do in this book, which is she went out into the park and started spending time with the relatively few people who were still going there day to day. And those were the dog walkers. Mm-hmm. And she thought, if I can do something that'll improve the experience of the dog walkers, then they'll tell their friends and maybe that'll be a small win that I can generate. And that's exactly what she did. She figured out what it was that dog walkers wanted more than anything else. And it turns out, by getting to know the dog walkers, spending time with them, asking some occasional questions, the story revealed itself to her pretty quickly. And that was that they wanted a way to take their dogs off the leash, because at that time, all dogs had to be leashed at all times.
Right, right.
And so she was able to get a law or an ordinance or something passed in the city council that allowed owners to take dogs off the leash at certain times. And that, I believe, those were some of the first leash laws mm-hmm. in the United States. Hmm. So it was actually a big win beyond New York City. But at the time, it was this little win that showed dog walkers that someone was listening to them and mm-hmm. would make changes on their behalf to improve their experience. And you know, Tricia, from the work you've done in the public sector, when constituents see that someone is looking out for their interests, they're just right. really appreciative.
Right.
And so more people right. started showing up, and that started a ball rolling.
Right.
So years later, when Prospect Park called Creative Good to help them, Prospect Park was now a thriving city park, just a center of social life on the weekends and after work and during the day. And it was just, and still is, just beautifully maintained with lots of different activities for people. But the management of Prospect Park had this issue that they were trying to come up with some new communications, signage and marketing and so on. And they wanted to know what their focus should be. How should they include people more and get people more involved in the park? You know, what should they focus on? Should they talk about the Audubon Center or the Boathouse or these activities, or what should it be? And so a bunch of folks from Creative Good spent time in the park, just like Tupper Thomas had done years before. And once again, the story revealed itself pretty quickly. Once you spent some time with your constituents, you know, you figure it out. And the thing about Prospect Park is there's a ring road. It used to be a carriage trail where people would ride their horse and ride in their carriages, horse-drawn carriages around the park, this big circular road.
Right, and like Central Park has the same thing.
It does, although it's more pronounced in Prospect Park, because there's outside of the ring road, what we could perhaps call the periphery of Prospect Park. And then most of the park is inside that ring road. That's where the Boathouse is. That's where the Audubon Center is.
Okay.
And what we figured out is that for whatever reason, most visitors to the park would not cross that road. They were very comfortable coming into the periphery, setting up their picnic, and then when they're done, leaving. And so they were missing all of the treasures that were inside the park. And so there's more details in the case study.
Yeah,
but
that
was the hook. And so we figured out and fed back to the board at Prospect Park, we have to come up with communications, signage, and so on that encourages people just to go just 20 yards further in.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
they'll, all of these vistas will open up to them, and that's what they did, and it was a big success.
Yeah.
But again, it was just the, whether it was us or Tupper Thomas, it was just the act, the very simple act of including people by spending time with them, getting to know them, and figuring out what it is that they want is the key action.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think a couple of things struck me about this example, which I think we can all pretty much relate to especially if you live in an urban area where, you know, you visit your local park or whatnot. And a couple of things about it, especially for me, that resonate. Well, one is that it's, you know, it's a park that's managed and run by the city. So it's a public space. It's meant to be used by everybody. I'm guessing you didn't get into all the details, but I'm assuming that when they hired Tupper Thomas and subsequently your firm to help them with making the experience, improving the experience, they started out with a goal or a set of goals. It wasn't just about, you know, how do we get more dog walkers? How do we make dog walkers happy? Or how do we make better signage? It's really like, those were just sort of the keys and sort of the pathways to actually creating a something bigger and better for everybody. So their ultimate goal was really to engage the public in the park and to get people to participate and thrive. And really, I mean, I think part of this is, how do you, you know, thinking about the work that you do and the work that I do in terms of understanding your customers or the constituents that you're working with, ultimately getting towards a bigger goal, you know, not just creating a good experience for today, but rather how do we create a good experience for a lot of people for a very long time? And that's something that really, I thought, struck me about the case. The other thing that struck me was when you started out, which I thought was really interesting, was you started out by describing that simple experience of just, you know, that the dog walkers and this rule that they had to keep their dogs on leashes. And I think we all, as people who, you know, we're all citizens of, you know, there's rules out there, right? And oftentimes we say, God, you know, why do we have this stupid rule? Why does the government have this stupid rule? If we just didn't have this rule, you know, life would be so much easier. My life would be so much better. My experience would be better. And so it's also about, like, where is it possible to challenge those rules? Almost like sort of challenging the design of something that was designed 150 years ago. You know, when is it possible? When is it appropriate to sort of challenge those rules for the greater good, for the ultimate goal of getting to what you want to achieve? And I'm curious if you, you know, just in sort of your experience also, when you talk to users or you talk to customers, you know, how the idea of a rule exists, you know, is it time to break that rule? Is it time to move beyond that rule for the greater good? Or I don't know if that's something that you know, came up in your conversations about the public parks or other areas that you've worked in.
Well, I don't know that it's an interesting idea that it turns out there's this rule that nobody likes and mm-hmm. it's changeable. It turns out it's not that hard to change. Mm-hmm. And that often comes up, but that's not usually the entry point into the research that we're aware of that. Mm-hmm. I like how you separated out two complementary ideas here. One is that the organization has an overriding goal. We want to increase public usage of this park, or we want to increase public engagement of whatever the service is that mm-hmm. this agency is involved in. Mm-hmm. At the same time, when you begin a project to achieve that goal, you can't just do vague research, like how do we improve public engagement and go out to right. the public and say, how do we engage you?
Right.
What you have to do is you have to find some concrete context in which mm-hmm. you can make some improvement, or you have to look for some detailed pain point. Mm-hmm. In other words, you have a goal that's out there. Mm-hmm. That's broad and a little abstract, but you have to start with something that's real and measurable. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But you can't, this is the thing about the rule. In my experience, you can't know what that detail is until you get in there and just start
that's
flailing
right.
around a bit. And then you find almost every time, this is the weird thing, Tricia. When you go into this research, again, I write quite a bit about this listening lab methodology, which it does have some aspects that are anthropological, like you said, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. but it's smaller scale and it's a little more directed toward the institution's goal. But anyway, you get into these semi non-directed conversations with very different people, person mm-hmm. A, person B, person C, and once you know, person after person starts bringing up the same pain point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean mm-hmm. it. It, mm-hmm. almost every time.
Yeah.
And you're like, how did, and then yeah. When you get to the end of the research, you go, of course, it's the leash laws. Like, how did we not know that? But there was no way to know that going in. You know, you think about Tupper Thomas, it could have been, there were so many things wrong with Prospect Park in 1979. It could have been the buildings that were burned out. It could have been the litter. It could have been the illegal drug activity that was occurring in the park. It could have been, you know, it could have been anything that she could have, on a whiteboard, she could have hypothesized. But for teams that really want to get out and understand what a pain point is, you have to let go of your hypotheses and really open up to listening to what the people are giving you, and then they'll tell you. And then that's the moment when you say, now we have this thing, now what do we do with it? Now you have your, what you, you the example you said, now you've figured out what the rule is that no one likes, and now you can start working to fix it from there. And once you do that, then you're building some momentum toward that larger goal.
Well, so, and I want to just follow up on that, because I think, and you sort of mentioned this earlier too, which is, and I think this is so important, and I see this a lot in my work as well, when I have conversations, particularly on behalf of, say, a government agency or nonprofit that's trying to do something good, and they call people together and they say, hey, we want to hear what you think. We want to hear what you need or what your pain points are. And they have these conversations and they're very engaging, and then nothing happens. And I think, I mean, we've all had that experience, I'm sure, where we've been to meetings and we've talked and talked and talked, and we all know what the problem is, but the people who are in the power to make a change, you know, and I'm curious, you know, I'm wondering if, you know, I don't know, I'm speculating, but I don't know if Tupper Thomas sort of went into it sort of knowing that in advance, like knowing that in order to demonstrate good faith, in order to be able to pull more out and be able to, like, as you said, that was sort of the first step. But in order to take it further, did she sort of know that she needed to do something concrete, because it's not enough to just listen and hear from people. As I often say, you know, you have to treat people's time, you know, you have to respect people's time. You have to treat it as almost like currency. Like, people's time and ideas are currency, and you need to value that. And if you don't, and I say if you, meaning, you know, if the entity that's looking for this information, whether it's the government agency or the sponsor, whoever's building something, experience, if they don't do something, there's a real risk that you're going to alienate people even further. And of course, you're not going to really, and you're less likely to accomplish the goals that you're trying to aim for.
Well, let me ask you that then, Tricia, because this is your expertise in public sector consulting. What do you think is behind that when, let's say, you do the research, you come up with suggestions, recommendations, it's based in factual observation and whatever analysis you've done of the research method that you've used. You present it nicely and clearly to the stakeholders within the agency or whoever the client is, and then nothing happens. Why is it? You tell us, why is that?
Yeah. So I think this is one of those areas where I feel like, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't work in the consumer product or commercial sector. My sense, what I've heard from people, you know, having done a lot of this work on both sides of the aisle, you know, having been an information provider as well as somebody who's asking people to participate in gathering information about their experience, is that this is going to sound really cynical, but because oftentimes these initiatives are run, you know, they're run by a political person, or if it's run by a person in political position, first of all, you don't know whether the funding is there to actually do anything with it. So it could be, you know, we want to hear from the public about this. We don't know what their ultimate intention is. We also know that there are certain, you know, it's sort of, you know, the optics, as they say, are that you need to make a best faith effort. You need to engage at some point. You need to have a public hearing, for example. You need to show that you care about the people you're serving, whether you're, you know, the commissioner of health or the commissioner of, you know, chancellor of the board of, or the, you know, education, or it doesn't matter what position you're in. you're trying to show the public, you're trying to show the public that you really do care, and therefore you're going to engage in a series of town halls, listening sessions, whatever you want to call them. But it's a lot more, there's more to it than that, right? And what happens is that there's this, like I said, there's this risk that you spend all this time, you know, you being the agency, the government, the sponsor of the product or service who does this and hasn't really thought through, well, what's our end goal? What do we want to actually do with this? Do we have any money to do anything? Do we have the resources? Do we have staff? Do we have anything that we can do with this? Or is it so politically unpalatable that it doesn't matter what people say, you know, it's never going to be successful, but we have to do this because that's what people say we need to do because they're our constituents and they vote for us. So that's kind of what I've heard and what I've seen and what I think a lot of people have expressed and experienced. And unfortunately, I feel like that's also, you know, why, you know, there's you sort of people choose not to participate when they have an opportunity because they really don't feel like their voice is going to make much of a difference, unfortunately. So
that's another example of what we were finding when we spoke last week, these connection points between the public and private sector, because you're talking about stakeholders, maybe elected officials who are a little bit nervous about launching something without doing a town hall, without doing some other methods of insurance to make sure that this is the right thing before they implement. And I can say something similar from the private sector side as a consultant over the years. I don't know how many projects and companies Creative Good has worked with over the years, but it's in the hundreds. Mm. And so you see some patterns over the years. And one is that even when the client is really enthusiastic about your work, and you do, and you get great results from the research, and you have just what you think is just a home run of mm-hmm. recommendations, really based on good observation and good analysis. Mm. If the even in that best of circumstances, if the client takes 20% of your recommendations, that's incredible. mm-hmm. And it's not because clients are dumb or anything. It's the same sort of thing that you're talking about, that people from the perspective of a stakeholder, let's say it's a senior vice president who has a big budget, they bring in this consulting firm. The consulting firm goes out and talks to people and comes back with this report saying you should do the following things. Oh, these are pretty big changes. You know, if this doesn't work, it's going to be my head.
Right.
So how can I de-risk some of these changes? Well, how about we do the low-hanging fruit, the ones that my gut also, this is the perspective again of the stakeholder. My gut is that these two or three recommendations are pretty harmless. They seem good. Let me try those. And of course they work. But by the time they do those three, then it's on to the next crisis. And the other 5 or 6 or 10 mm. recommendations go untested. Mm. But that's the life of a consultant. And I don't know if you would agree with this or how much you would agree with this in the public sector. But for me in the private sector, that's life, baby. Yeah. You do the research, the analysis, you make the recommendations, and they take 10% of it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. No, I deal with that a lot, and I don't. You know, my role is just to do the research for them, help them figure out what options they have, help you know do some analysis to kind of give them the options and say, okay, you know, here's A, B, and C, or here's what the customers are saying, here's what your constituents are saying, here's what they're saying. You know, worked well or didn't work well. Here's what we want in our local school district. You know, we can do all of that. I think the challenge though is that when you call upon the same people again and again and again, and I don't know, maybe it's different. The public sector, I think oftentimes, you know, they're really, and again, this is my naivete also, is that oftentimes there isn't money to incentivize people to participate in those town halls and listening sessions. And so if you have alienated your voter base or your constituents, because they don't really trust that what you're going to do, you say you're really going to do what you say you care about, and you're relying on them to come out without any incentive, without any payment, without, you know, just give up a couple of hours once a month at night to come and participate in something purely as a volunteer, you know, that gets to be, after a while, you kind of lose faith in people. And so I think that's part of the challenge. But I hear what you're saying. You know, there's that political risk, I guess everybody has to avoid.
Yeah.
Regardless.
Yeah. Yeah. It's easier for the consultant to make these grand pronouncements, but it's absolutely not their career on the line.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, this is a great kickoff to a longer conversation, Tricia. I think we've set out some boundary markers for a good context about the similarities and some of the differences between private and public sector consulting. I'd like to extend this. I'd like to get into some other examples and have you give some examples next time. What do you
Absolutely.
Think?
Yeah. I've got, like I said, I've got probably about at least a dozen ideas I could discuss with you. And just, I would love to just explore like where are there more opportunities, more sort of overlap, where can we learn from each other? Where can we sort of share, you know, our own pain points in terms of the work that we do? Because I know that you are very passionate about your work in terms of engaging customers in the process of designing good products and good experiences. You know, and I also am just, you know, there's always things that I look at every day in my experience as a New York citizen, as a New Yorker who just, we all experience something challenging, whether it's a subway ride or something happening in our daily lives. But yeah, so there's a lot of things I would love to continue exploring with you, and hopefully we can do this again soon.
Great.
Thank you.
Again, Tricia Davies, Davies.
Yes.
And where can people find you online?
At thepublicgoodconsulting.com.
And my name is Mark Hurst, H-U-R-S-T, and I'm at creativegood.com. So if you don't know one of us or either of us, come find us, and hopefully we'll be back soon with another conversation. Tricia, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Mark. It's great.